Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is Dyralyn Evans. I'm joined today with my co-host Molly Martin and James Stiegel. Hi, everyone.
Hey, Dyralyn. How are you?
So before we jump into our exciting topic, I want to see what you guys are excited about in the writing world this week.
I am excited about finishing my edits, both because I'm finishing them and because they're edits.
Yay! James, how about you?
For me, writing. I'm finishing a novel this month, and so that's pretty much all. I'm just drafting, getting words out every day as fast as I can.
Awesome. I was just at Right Here, Right Now in Seattle, which is a pretty magical day of put on by the Seattle Seven Writers, where you go in and they have a little 10-minute writing craft talk, and then you write for 45 minutes, and you take a little 5-minute break and rinse and repeat all day long, and it is super splendid. You get a ton of writing done. I was really excited about my progress. And I was in the same room as Jamie Ford. So, super fun. All right. Well, let's go ahead and turn to our topic. This season on the podcast, we're focused on the elements of next level world building, where we push up against a concept, a basic concept of world building, and add details for realism. Today, we're talking about politics. Molly, do you want to start us off with a good definition of what we mean when we say politics and world building?
Sure. Thanks, Dyralyn. The basic definition that we're using is that politics is the social structure that guides a group from the smallest band of hunter-gatherers to an intergalactic empire spanning multiple planet systems. So it encompasses everything from laws to customs to even religion. How does that play into what people do in their day-to-day lives?
Awesome. All right. So where do we start?
I like to start with humans gonna human. I think you got to remember that no matter any given system, people are going to still act in human ways. And I think one of the things that's difficult about world building is to approach it totally rationally, which I think is what we want to do, so it'll make sense. But then to remember how human nature can play into that, which kind of ties into our first thing we have here on the list, which is cooperation versus conflict. So what are some ways that you all have thought about conflict when it comes to world building, like especially when you're starting with a character?
Well, I think for me, I think all of us are pretty familiar with the adage that conflict is story and conflict is character and conflict drives your story. So I think a lot of times we get sort of focused and wrapped up in this idea that everything has to start in the middle of the war. Everything has to start in the middle of the chase. Everything, you know, otherwise there's going to be no story if there's no conflict. But one of the things that I think is really interesting, and especially talking about politics, is if you're in politics, the idea is that war should be the last thing that you want. I mean, war is going to destabilize your country. War is going to, you know, stress your resources. It's going to kill your population. So looking at the politics of conflict versus cooperation, how militaristic is your society? Are they more, you know, sort of educated and enlightened and they want to have a debate about something, or do they immediately want to go to war? So I think of it, this is sort of the division between Athens and Sparta, if you want to take it back to the Greeks. So that's a good place to start talking about politics. Let's start with the Greeks. So when I'm looking at building a political system, one of the things that I'm looking at immediately is if there's cooperation, who is cooperating with who and what are they motivated by? Are they going to be motivated by family ties? Are they going to be motivated by money? Are they people that are trying to move up in a caste system? So why are people cooperating? And then if they're not cooperating, that cooperation breaks down and turns into conflict. What causes the breakdowns to happen? Or if it's a ritualized sort of conflict that everybody's agreed on, is that just another form of cooperation? Like, okay, we're going to all have duels, but we're not really going to have a war. So even though there's a conflict, it's a cooperative conflict.
I was just thinking that as you were saying, you know, ritualized society, like the whole idea that that's actually a codified sort of cooperation, which is really interesting. And I think you can get into some really cool character stuff there, because you can still have interesting conflict and characters expressing world building through the ways that they interact with each other, because that system, like once you set that up for your characters and let them run around inside that box, it basically expresses the world building through the way they, you know, interact with each other. And I think that's a cool way to look at it. One of the things that we overall wanted to try and touch on is ways to express world building without just doing an info dump. And I think when you come up with kind of an action oriented system, like something like this, you know, Athens versus Sparta, I was smarter on that. I haven't seen 300 and I need to, I guess, go brush up on my pop culture and what people are, you know, aware of. But I think that's a way where the minute we put two characters in this situation, you know, in the arena, we're expressing world building through the ways that they, you know, hammer each other with their axes or whatever, you know. I don't know. Do you think that's tied into it, or am I not getting at what you're thinking of?
No, I think I think you're following along pretty well with what I was thinking. And I like the suggestion of you're giving a conflict, but it's not necessarily right in the middle of the war. It's happening at a level that you can start getting into the world building aspects of it, especially if it's like a ritualized conflict. So for example, I mean, we just had the Super Bowl pretty recently, and you can't tell me that people are not, you know, sometimes invested very life or death in the outcome of a football game. And so you can have those forms of conflict, but it is also a form of cooperation. I mean, you know, we're not going to start a war if, you know, one team wins or the other team doesn't do as well as we thought they were going to.
We might trash our city, but, you know, we're not going to start
a little
war.
Bit. Yeah.
I almost wish we could. Like, why can't we just solve world problems through football? It would be much easier. But
well, and that, I think that brings us nicely kind of to one of the other topics that we were going to talk about, which is sort of the power brokers and the powers behind the throne. So we have, let's, you know, kind of go with the football analogy or soccer, depending on where you are in the world. So you have these people, or even the Olympics, you have these people that are out there representing their nation or their society. But you also have the people behind those people, you know, the people who are deciding who is going to be the person out there representing us. What rules are we going to follow? What constitutes cheating? What constitutes, you know, this is a good play?
And I think those are all ways you can say things about your society. You know, if the first image you had in your mind was, you know, whatever, a field where two people are in conflict, or maybe it's even, you know, they're playing a game, like it's an Ender's Game kind of scenario with we're working together towards a goal or two teams working against the goal. You can start expressing all those things through that event. And then you can also step outside it to who are the coaches, just like you're getting at, and what do those relationships look like? You know, what do they want from that? You know, how do those relationships work to get what each character wants? Because that's going to say a lot about the world they live in, right? It makes me think of Quidditch and how, you know, J.K. Rowling used Quidditch as a mechanism to, you know, whenever the text was getting kind of slow in Harry Potter, we just drop a Quidditch game in the plot. But it's also a way to kind of play with and explain other things about how, you know, wizards are competitive and wizards are petty and wizards, you know, all the things they use to kind of give more information about the wizarding world, you know, through that mechanism. Who are the power brokers in Quidditch? Now I got to think about this. Like, I guess the various, you know.
Well, and there was such a developed betting structure around Quidditch that seems like that's where a lot of the real power would lie.
You know, we were just talking about Star Wars before we started up, and the pod racing in episode one, like, was actually a pretty good, it helped you get invested in the character. It helped you see the technology. It helped you see what the characters wanted, sort of, I guess, to make cool pod racers. But also you got to see the people that were betting on, you know, and had something to gain or lose from the outcome of the pod race. So all that was a way, it probably could have been done better, but a way to give information about the world where we first meet Anakin Skywalker.
I think that's also a really great way to begin to see those social structures and that, like, who's in power. There's always the platform for the very rich people kind of floating above where they're gathered with delicious snacks and servants serving them. And then there are the groundlings in the trenches, you know, betting, they're the small bets and whatnot. And that's a very visual, easy, quick way to see here's who's in power, here is kind of the social structure through the games. So kind of interesting. Yeah. I want to take the idea of power brokers and power behind the throne, because we, you know, we're talking about world building in a very grand scheme, but I think you can also do that in a smaller scheme. Of course, even just in a, if this is not a huge world story, but we're looking at a village or a small country, or even, you know, a domestic story where we're looking at a shop, there are power brokers, and you can see, you know, who's the manager of the shop, and you know, who's the secretary or executive assistant blocking them, you know, or protecting them, and who are, you know, and how do the politics work? How do you get the raise? How those things? I think that it scales. It's from vast world to small world as well. Thinking about those ideas. And I think it's important to have politics at all of those levels. You know, you can have the great kings and queens and whatnot, but then you also, as you are looking at the smaller pieces of the world, there are politics within that have similar kinds of structures.
Yeah, something we've been talking about at work, actually, is influence without power, you know, soft power. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I... And I think from a world building perspective with a character, like, how, you know, that could be something to think about. Like, okay, I have characters with overt power, and then I have characters with soft power, and how do they exercise their soft power, and how much do they actually influence the world, you know, the world as a whole, you know? And that could be a really interesting way. Like, just looking at, like, that shop scenario, you know, there might be the, you know, even though you've got a boss who's in charge, there might be a family history there. You've also got the up and coming young clerk who, you know, comes in with great ideas, realizes she gets a lot of pushback, so figures out how to help the boss be convinced that he thought of those things or whatever. But all that can help illustrate how the world works by expressing soft power, you know, as well. We need to make a checklist, I think, of all these things.
All these great ideas. We will have to do that. I think that actually really ties back, thinking about soft power, is a little bit of the dichotomy we were talking about at the beginning of cooperation versus conflict. Is when you're the person that has the overt power, it's just, well, you know, I'm in charge, you're going to do what I say. You don't have to get a consensus. You don't have to cooperate. You don't have to make a compromise. If you're not that person on the top, you do. You've got to, you know, rally the rest of the peasantry and get them on your side. Or, you know, you've got to find more subtle ways to get what you want. And for me, it's always more interesting to see how are people going to resolve, you know, how are people going to advance their agenda when they're the people that aren't in power, that can't just say, you know, I'm the ruler and what I say goes.
Well, I think even when you do have something like a strict monarchy or a dictatorship or something where someone has absolute power, it's very rare that they really truly have absolute power. There are people who they have to cooperate with or serve. So, you know, kings and queens in Britain had to still get the cooperation of the lords, and they might do it through conflict in taxation, but they also had to get their cooperation so that they didn't get usurped. And so I think that, so even on that grand scale, would definitely something that's important to think about.
Which brings up a point of resources. You know, okay, I'm in charge, but someone else might control a thing that I need. So how does that really come into play? And I know we're not necessarily talking about resources or economic systems today, but certainly that's a function of, you know, politics moves to secure resources to support, you know, certain things. So that's a really interesting thing to think about, especially as you kind of design your political system, you know, where if I have a, if I'm dealing with a parliamentary system or a king or a, you know, whatever, a queen, what's the queen might have absolute power, but what is standing in the way of her actually getting things done? You know, what does she need to make that happen? Either it's a matter of distance or resources or people, all of those things would come into play.
One of the other things that we had on the list, I think that's kind of related to this, are the history and things like grudges, vendettas, scores to settle, that might also play into this idea of cooperation versus conflict. You know, you have the civil war rivals in sports often, and I'm sure this is true at the country level. What are the past grudges or incidents that might create a lot of the prejudice or fear between countries or worlds or whatnot. So, thoughts
there?
We
have these really actually in our, to use our own world as an example, because what else do we have? So we have this example of, okay, England. So England and France, maybe not the best of friends, occasionally get along, but occasionally go to war with each other for, you know, decades at a time. And then you have England versus the U.S. We also had a war with England, but I would say that, you know, overall, we seem to have a much better relationship with England. So what is the difference between how England and France relate to each other versus how England and the United States relate to each other? And I think it does have a lot to do with this idea of vendettas and grudges and scores. And there's just so much history that has happened on the European continent between those two groups of people. They've just built up all of these scores that have to be settled and all of these grudges. And it's just this really big dysfunctional family kind of setting. Versus the US, where we're like, okay, we're just going to get a divorce. But it's sort of, you know, over the years, it's become amicable. And now we are all getting along fairly well.
Well, it even brings up, let's say, how do the people within your system think about the future? You know, is the past more important than the future? Is the past have meaning to them? You know, if the idea of ancestors and my great, 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 great grandfather was murdered by an Englishman, and that's important to me, that's going to play into the decisions I make, right? So that could be a really interesting aspect of the history to think about. In the United States, we just don't seem to be as focused on history as much as other countries are. You know, a big, I don't know, it so many wars have been justified, it seems like, in Europe based on history as a thing that can, you know, that idea can be exploited to get what people in power want, you know, by playing up the idea that we were wronged at some point in the past and we deserve these things. Whereas in the US, I don't know, that hasn't been as much of an issue. But thinking about the character, your character in your situation, what is pushing on them about that? And will they accept it or reject it? And what does that mean for them? And then how can you express, you know, that's actually would be a really cool way to kind of explain the history of a country through how characters feel about that versus just having the big prologue info dump of, you know, 400 years ago, there was a war between such and such and this thing happened, and now we're all dealing, you know, whatever.
And we've been mad ever since.
Right, exactly. What was it? Bright on Netflix was just like that, you know, and the whatever, the humans and the elves fought the orcs, and now we're all mad. But you never quite get you kind of get a sense of how that works through the characters, but they just had a big info dump at the beginning and didn't really, you just didn't feel it as much, you know, of how it mattered to people's everyday lives. And it was also, in that story in particular, it was 2,000 years ago. So it was hard to really figure out, like I'm really not mad about the Romans in a lot of ways, you know, whatever. I can be, I guess, irritated we don't have as good indoor plumbing, but.
I mean, you know, other than what happened to the library at Alexandria, I think
right.
We're all okay.
I'm gonna go burn some people over that.
We're writers. We're still mad about that. There was a library. It got burned. You guys don't understand.
So, pardon me. So I want to bring this into maybe some specific examples so we can kind of see how some of these concepts are working. Recently, we spoke with Miko Azul about her book, The Staff of Fire and Bone. And I'm thinking in particular about the history and grudges here. And she has a land where there are several different kind of religious, different social groups. And one of them stole the Firestone from the other, and they're very bitter about this. So there's definitely some grudges between two of the groups, and there's a third group that they have demon magic, and so one group is very against them.
So there's this conflict between these two groups in Miko Azul's book, The Staff of Fire and Bone. And one of the group is perceived or as actually demonized by the other group and say, these people are demons and they stole our Firestone. And we are severely angry about that for quite a long time. And then the other group that actually did this deed justifies it to themselves by saying, well, this other, you know, the people that we stole the Firestone from, these are slightly lesser people, so there's a dehumanizing going on, and there's an othering that's going on. They're slightly less people-like than we are. We are good people, they are lesser people. And so therefore, they can't be trusted with something that's really powerful. So in a sort of very colonial way, they've justified it to themselves, saying, well, we're trying to protect them from themselves, because obviously they're just idiots. And so I think one of the good things in world building that her book does is because it follows multiple point of view characters, is it gives us an insight into each of those cultures, how they perceive the other and how they perceive themselves, and how those interplay and motivate the characters who come from those cultures. And then once they run up against actual people from the opposing culture, how do they navigate those prejudices that they have? And you know, how do they realize, okay, you did do this to us. We understand why you did it, but it's still wrong. Or, you know, are we just going to kill you on sight?
Yeah, and she does a good job of further complicating that, because these two groups who have not been cooperative are now under attack by a third group, and so they end up having to work together on top of at the same time trying to navigate those old prejudices and grudges. This brings up a really good moment to talk about racism and classism. In the Staff of Fire and Bone, there are definitely a lot of that going on with the different groups. In terms of speciesism? Literally, some of them are demons, or they have this demon magic, and so are a kind of a different race or species than some of the other groups. But there's definite kind of racism going on there, and classism. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that works in world building, and maybe how it comes out of, you know, these ideas of either histories or grudges or cooperation versus conflict?
I think that in a lot of situations where there is a war, in order for there to be a war, you have to convince the people that they need to go and kill other people. And that's one of the biggest taboos that we have, is you don't kill other people. So in order to kill somebody else, you have to kind of convince your warrior class or your warrior caste or whoever's going to be doing the fighting that those that they are fighting are different and other and lesser. And so it's not this great crime. It's not this great taboo against humankind to go and murder a bunch of people, because they're not really people. So I think that history can actually play into a sort of racism, because if you start out and saying, well, they're different from us because, you know, we wear red sashes and they wear slightly orange sashes. And eventually, you know, this becomes this huge divide over time and just gets exaggerated and blown out of proportion. And I think that's kind of where you can see a lot of racism being founded, is you just pick some detail about another group of people and say, well, it's different from us and therefore bad. If you're doing this as a world building thing, I think you need to, again, think about how do the people perceive that in themselves? Because racism is a word that has, you know, very negative connotations. And people are not going to knowingly engage in something unless you're, you know, just a diabolical villain that they believe to be bad. So you constructing this racist society need to understand, how is it not racist to the people themselves? How are they justifying it in their own mind? And then do you have extremes? Do you have people who are, you know, against this form of racism? Do you have people who are, you know, very in favor of this form of racism, and how does that conflict within the society? Because no society is going to be a monolith. Not everybody there, you know, say you're going to have an elf race and a human race or something. Not 100% of the humans are going to hate 100% of the elves, and vice versa. So where along that continuum does your character lie, or multiple characters, and how best can you show that continuum to the reader, again, without it being an info dump?
I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that just extremes are kind of boring. You know, I think, at least they are to me. I think depending on the type of fiction that you are working on, like maybe that's what your audience wants, is extremes. I don't want to have to think about these things in a realistic way. But something that I often try and keep in mind is just that there aren't really bad guys. So they certainly don't see themselves that way. And so how do we get to either side of this and justify it for each character? I don't know. It seems like that's a whole, as I think about ideas about like racism and classism, especially in fantasy, where people really technically are different. Like that kind of feels like an out, you know? So you know, the whole point of why these things don't really make any sense is that at least in our world, we're not actually different. We just make up, like you were saying, we make up these ways to other each other. But I think it's really important to keep that in mind, that when you think about that cooperation versus conflict, like how are your, if you have two sides or three sides of a conflict, how are they alike versus how are they different, you know, and how do we kind of have characters that show both those aspects of whatever, a people, a system, and then how do I use that to highlight the world building? You know, how do I use those things to make my world more real? And having characters, I think, that see that spectrum about other parts of the world can really help make that more real. I think it's, you know, starting from that as an idea, especially as a way to drive your plot, can be difficult, but as a way to weave it in can definitely make things more real, you know, depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
So you made a really good point there when you said in fantasy or even in sci-fi, where you literally have races that are physically different. These ones come from planet X, these ones come from planet Y. They are demonstrably different and not different in, you know, just some functional minor visual way. But one of the other issues that we had on our list to talk about is gender. So that's mm-hmm. something that, you know, we do have a physical difference amongst humans. And I think when you're addressing your politics, that's something that needs to be addressed as well. Your politics is going to be one of the things immediately that's going to show your reader, how is the society set up as far as gender equality? Is there gender equality? Is that a priority? Are men and women in equal positions of power? If so, you as the writer have to be really cognizant of the fact that there's going to be need to be 50% representation, not just of females in power, but females in other positions. You know, you're going to need to have female guards. You're going to need to have male nurses. You know, some of those stereotyped gender roles that we think of, you know, not every cleric has to be a female, not every warrior has to be a male, to use D&D references. but your politics is going to be a great place to show that. And then you've got sort of the social norms versus the legal norms. So legally, you might have perceived gender equality, but do you actually have gender equality in your society?
Right.
I think in thinking about racism, classism, gender equality, one of the interesting things to me is thinking about how recent or how long ago did some of these divisions come to be, so that you kind of can see do those create issues? For example, in contemporary society, it's only been fairly recently that women are, you know, work outside the home and can even, you know, can vote and can have own their own property, those kinds of things. So thinking about that and how that would work in another world, we still have issues of there's a very traditional sense of what a woman should be. At the same time, she needs to be out in the world working and having power. And so there, it creates a real stress on viewing women and how we view women, that they need to be strong. And at the same time, they need to be, you know, the home and hearth maker. the same with things like classism. We see recent, there's a lot of new money right now in the tech world. And historically, in England, as the merchant class was coming up, that put a real strain and stress on the traditional monarchy in the 16, 17, 1800s. And so, which changes society in very subtle and then also very dramatic ways. I wonder if, I'm just putting that out there, something to think about, and how long those prejudices are, or how recent things might have come up, and how that's going to create the dynamic of racism or classism or the gender issues.
And something you just said, Darylyn, that really is interesting to me is the whole idea of stress, like that stress as an in-between place to express world building. You know, that I've thought of these concepts. I've got my pieces in place. My characters are on the board. I've established the rules of my game. Now, how can I express that through the stress between characters, you know, or the stress on a character, or just like what Molly was saying about, we might have, you know, the queen says, this is how we live, but actually this is how we live, and the stress of trying to do those things is making my character very unhappy, you know? And so why is that? And expressing that is a way to, that's all a function of the world the character lives in. And so I think that's a way you can express all those things without just, you know, info dumping that information. You know, the character is going to figure it out, or the reader is going to figure it out through the character, and they'll understand why. You know, it's not just an intellectual thing of like, you know, that sucks, I'm in the class that is downtrodden. Well, no, let's actually see your life and see how that feels like and what it's like to be you, and thinking about that stress and the pain points, you know, I think can really make things very, very real. Those transitions too, like what you were just mentioning with our tech transitions and how our economy is changing, and even thinking about, you're right, like the way the mercantile class worked in the 1600s versus today, and we can't see any of those things now. So how are those transitions happening, and how might they be impacting, you know, the characters in your world? Like, maybe it doesn't even play into the story, but like, push your story forward 100 years, and what are things going to be like? And then think about all the things the characters can't see now that might be changing, you know, if you're writing an epic fantasy or an epic, you know, science fiction story.
Well, and that's actually a great place to go back to the conflict of the story, because when you're having conflict where it's not a war, it's not a battle, it's not something that's sort of a fight scene thrown in there just, or a Quidditch match just because the story has slowed down. It's, you know, this is one of those character versus environment, or character versus, you know, almost versus their society, or, you know, class versus class, or caste, if you have a strong caste system. And I think sometimes we tend to conflate class system with a caste system. There are a lot of similarities, but I think in a caste system, it's almost, to me, it feels almost similar to a form of racism, where you've just picked out something about another person and then relegated them in your mind to a certain rung of, you know, society, and said, you know, no matter what, because you are born this way, you know, you will never be anything else but this. Whereas classism, you know, we sort of allow people to move up and down in that societal rung, and we might not like the new money, you know, if we're the nobility, but, you know, we're certainly not going to react to it as strongly as if we truly believe, you know, this is a divinely ordained system with me at the top, conveniently.
Well, even that's kind of a cop-out. If you have a god or a deity that said this is how it is.
Yeah.
Now we've taken agency away from our characters, and it's hard to, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes you look, taking these various things that we're talking about, I think makes it easy to sort of see behind the scenes on various, you know, in various stories, like, oh, there was a god that made it like this, and that's why this happens. And so, you know, humans didn't have much to do with it. It's just they're unwitting pawns in the system, you know, but I don't know. For me, that's what makes the story more satisfying, is if I feel like the author has really thought through these things. And if it was a god that did it, like how then can those stresses, like Darylyn was talking about, really be manifested to show the characters in that system?
And I think a lot of the interesting characters and that come out and I guess plot and action in those kinds of stories, they're come out of the folks who are caught in the middle of those systems rather than just the king and queen or the gods or the warrior, you know, the high warrior class or lords. I think that it's way more interesting to see either the stories that are coming out and interacting up and down the classes or the castes rather than just here is our prince and our, you know, fighting the dragon, whatever. I think those get a little bit old.
A little bit too simplistic. Recently, we also talked to Heather Ransom, author of Going Green, and she has what is a de facto caste system in her story, where she has this group of people that undergo a process that enables them to draw energy through, you know, they're basically injected with chloroplasts, and they're able to draw energy directly through photosynthesis, so they don't have to eat anymore, and they become green like plants. And then there's another group of people, and this group of people considers themselves better than everybody else and, you know, more community minded. And, you know, I'm going to dedicate all of my resources to helping society versus eating and consuming. And then you have this juxtaposed with people who either can't afford the procedure, which is a really sort of an interesting twist in the story, or who refuse to have the procedure done to them, you know, due to various moral or ethical issues that they have with it. And so we see, you know, in her story, we see a caste system forming, like we see the formation of this caste system where you have people who are physically differentiating themselves in some way. It really informs the trajectory of their lives and their careers. Like, you know, can they get into the good school? Can they get a good job? Can they get, you know, patroned by other people who are of, you know, the green people or the not green people? That's one way that you can have something that James, like you were saying, you have this thing that's functioning in the back of your story, and it never has to be explicitly stated in the story. I mean, she never calls it out and says, this is a caste system. But the reader, we as the reader, can see it happening. And I think that that is really one of the big keys to world building, is that you as the author have to know how all of this stuff is working. You know, you do a ton of world building, but you're not going to give that all to the reader, because that's where you're getting your info dumps and your huge paragraphs of exposition is, let me tell you how a caste system works, just in case you don't know.
Yeah. Well, you could be like Neal Stephenson and just go back, you know, 400 years to explain how orbital mechanics work all the way up to the future. But that's kind of his thing. And, you know, people hate it. Some people love it.
Isn't that Michener who...
Started with the dinosaurs
and the geology of the place.
Yeah, when Hawaii first came up from the ocean as a...
Now, to be fair, it works for some people. If you're Frank Herbert, you can certainly start with geology. We are not Frank Herbert, though. So just, you know that about yourself.
Well, and I think that readers aren't as patient with it as they used to be. You know, I think it all depends on the kind of market that you're writing for, but a lot of the newer, at least, you know, speculative fiction, I think that readers are more tolerant, but they also really want to get right to character as opposed to spending a lot of time trying to conceptualize a world, you know, and so that you've got maybe 5 pages that they might give you, and then they're kind of losing their interest, you know, so they'll wane if you don't keep them hooked into a character in some way.
Which is actually really, really important. One of the things that we've kind of been touching on a little bit in talking about everything else is, who is your point of view character? And how does that function in the story? And Daryl Lynn, you had mentioned, like, some of the most interesting characters to see are not the characters at the top or at the very bottom of you know, whatever their societal or political structure is, but sort of those characters in the middle or in the transitions. And can you talk a little bit more about that?
It's easy to create a political structure. Here we have a monarchy, we have queens and kings, and or some kind of emperor ruler, and all we see is life in the castle, and we don't get to see even the servants necessarily, or what's happening in the world around them. You know, who's out there farming and making the clothes and all of those kinds of things. And I think that's where, you know, all of the decisions that are made that happen in the castle affect all of these people's lives, but we don't often, or in older stories, don't always get those. And I think that's kind of boring. I think it's way more interesting when we get the stories that are happening out in, you know, here are the people that maybe these decisions are affecting, and who have to live out the, you know, the soldier who has to go fight that war, and you know, and who's not a general or a military position where they get to sit back on the hill and watch the fighting down below, but who is going to be down there are in mortal peril and where the, and what life they're coming out of, their families or their, you know, their loves, their children, those kinds of things. I think that's a way more interesting story. And as you were just saying, those places, you know, what's interesting about watching that is the people who are affected and where, you know, those stresses and in the bigger world picture that we get to see those happening to folks rather than, you know, get to hear about, oh, this historical thing happened, or we know what's going on out there. I'd rather see the mother who is struggling, you know, the working mother who's struggling with balancing, you know, family life and work life in whatever world that's happening in.
No, I think that's really important to think about. Like it sort of gets back to am I starting with a character? Am I starting with a world? Like, what is the interesting thing to me about the story I want to tell? And if it is, like, I had this idea of a world where people are injected with chloroform, you know, wherever Heather started with that story. I can't remember if she started with a character or the idea. Didn't she say it started in her class when they were talking about how people might eat in the future? I think.
Yeah, I think it started off as a thought experiment in her class.
Yeah. So from there, like, I guess my point is, so whatever is most interesting to you about the story, and then figuring out where do I need to look at this story to be most effective. In a way, maybe it's easier if you haven't started with a character, because if I have the idea of the world, then I can figure out the best point to and most interesting point to enter that world. But I do think once you have a really interesting world as a writer and to your readers, because they're going to want as much as they can get if you're doing a good job at it. And if you've thought about these things and you've come up with a really interesting, intriguing world, there's no reason that multiple books can't be multiple entry points, you know, and multiple series and in injecting hooks into your series so that you can come back to that and readers want to learn more, you know. And I think that's how your world building can kind of develop a momentum within itself. And if you do all these things we're talking about, it's easier for it to have that energy on its own, so that, well, wait a second, I mentioned that thing, or I haven't talked about a person growing up in that cast, and what's it like for them? You know, you can create whole new entry points for yourself into the world, which as an author, that kind of keeps your career going. So, but I think it's something to think about, you know, POVs, you know, where you're starting with the idea can create that entry point. If you don't quite get the entry point you wanted with one book, you can always go back and do it with another one or a different story.
James, you are actually a very good example of this, because I believe you have, what is it, 3 or 4 books now that are written in basically in a universe that was created by another writer, M.D. Cooper, and he has allowed other writers to basically come in and play in his universe. You know, there's this huge span of time that he's sort of outlined. These are the major things that happen, but there's so much going on in this universe that you can jump in and tell tons of stories in the universe without ever really running out of stories to tell.
Yeah, it's like writing a Star Wars novel. Yeah, that's that's basically what he's done, which I think has been great, you know, and the readers just want more and more and more. You know, there are people that just devour his stuff the day it comes out. So I think, you know, as we think about, you know, okay, all this world building seems like a lot of work, and why would I actually want to do that? And that's not, you know, why would I put all this work into something that I'm not actually going to write directly about? There's no reason you won't end up writing directly about it later on, you know? And I think the more real you make the world in your mind, because I think one thing we haven't even touched on here is that how do you capture all this? And I think it's definitely valuable to find some software that helps you capture these things. Like one great tip I just heard recently with a writer that uses Scrivener was he basically has folders in Scrivener for his world, his characters, you know, all those things. And then every time he starts a new project, he basically just copies over the Scrivener file, deletes the previous book, and then starts again so that he's got all that info in there. I can go back and reference it quickly. You know, but other people use OneNote. Some people use various wiki software. But capturing all these things, I think, helps make the world more real in your mind. And when it's more real in your mind, your readers are going to feel that, you know, and it's going to live and breathe. And you might get people asking to write in your world, you know, which will double your output and you'll make more money. Yeah, I think somehow we got from POVs to, I don't know, the hooks are something that is really, I think, a lot about, because I don't think there's necessarily any bad ideas, because even within any given world, there's going to be people that are off the wall and you know, edge of the spectrum. But even if somebody comes up with a crazy idea about your world, like, how could it potentially play into the characters in the world you've created? So, but anyway, all that kind of plays back into politics, because you might always get some powerful personality that comes in that throws everybody for a loop, right? And mm-hmm. turns your world upside down. How did that happen? Where did that person come from?
They're a loose cannon.
A loose cannon, exactly.
He's a nut that doesn't play by anybody else's rules.
Exactly. How do we reset this series?
I want to go back to something. We've talked a lot about politics, and we've referred to systems of government, mostly monarchies, but we haven't actually spoken specifically about how systems of government work versus maybe this larger idea of politics and, you know, forming the social structure. So how does a system of government work in there? How do you begin to think about that and create or structure that and maybe make them a little bit different than our traditional, in particular in fantasy, monarchy?
I'll be honest, like the actual nuts and bolts of government is the least interesting thing to me about world building. But what I do find interesting is things like councils or assemblies, or how can I get characters together to have them, you know, okay, if I'm going to explain what's happening in my galactic empire, can I have four senators get together and argue about it, and one hates the other because of some, you know, trade embargo, like in Star Wars, which is really cool to hear about. But, you know, something for me, that's what's more interesting. But I'm thinking of a book I read recently called Goblin Emperor, that where you learn about how the empire operates through the brand new emperor that has come into position via assassination. Not that he did that, but he is, you know, ascended because of it. But the way you learned about the empire through him and his experience, and the author, you know, basically used that mechanism to explain all the variances of the empire and how it operated. I don't know, Molly, what do you think about that? I mean, for me, that's not the thing I'm most interested in, but that's just me. So
I'm a little bit more interested in that from the point of view of looking at it from the historical lens, because I think if you're going to talk about a system of government, like you were saying earlier, James, you know, you can take something, some concept and say, let's push this out 100 years with it and see where it goes. Or, you know, let's look back at it 100 years in the past and see how did it evolve from this point. So I think if you're going to talk about your system of government, like, let's figure out how did the system of government arise. If it's something like, you know, a feudal system of government, well, how did that arise? And you don't necessarily have to write about it during the nice time when they actually had kings and queens. You know, you can write about this as a feudal society in its infancy, where you have people that are like, you know what, maybe I don't want to be peasants. And some guy with a sword comes up to them and is like, well, you're going to be peasants. And what is the conflict that happens there? How do people become members of their society? Does everybody want to become, to have that system of government? You know, I think maybe to start way back at the beginning is you could look at it as a cooperation versus conflict question again. Is your system of government more on the cooperation side? Is it more, you know, what we would think of as a democracy where everybody gets some kind of voice in the government? Or is it more on an authoritarian end of the spectrum where you've got, you know, divinely appointed or might makes right kind of people? And then how do they enforce that? How do they keep the peasantry from rising up against them? Do they have to placate them? Do they have to placate their nobles or their military? But I think there are so many potential systems of government that you can look at the history of your fictional world and figure out how would that system of government arise. You might even have something like if you had sort of a merchant nation, you know, where all of a sudden the mercantile class is the up and coming class. Do they so precede the nobility and create a new form of nobility? And then are people who used to be on the top, you know, now scapegoated and made to seem like, oh, well, they thought they were divinely inspired, but actually they weren't, and now we all hate them. And so then you have France and the guillotine and things like that.
Human nature.
Human's gonna human.
You know, the historical aspect is a way, because, you know, one of the things I think about is, okay, if I'm not good at thinking about the, you know, I'm not a social science major, so I can't tell you like the five different kinds of democracy or something, but coming at it from, I think, just like what you said, like, okay, this is a merchant people because I want them to be on ships and I want, you know, these things to be the driving force behind my story. Something like walking that out on how that would work, I think is a good way to come back at what kind of government you might choose, you know. Or if you want to create conflict there, like a king, you know, a monarchy that is trying to come to terms with a new mercantile class that has more power than they do, could also be an interesting thing. So I think there's a lot of interesting space to play in there, and like cool conflict to find.
We have a couple things that I would like to get to before we all say goodbye. And the question, one of the questions that we had is, what breaks the dream in world building? And I think I would be really interested to hear, what are your thoughts on, you know, at least for you and your experience, you're reading along, all of a sudden you're like, ugh.
Darylin, you're first.
I think a lot of it for me is when it does get a little bit info dumpy, or suddenly we're going to stop and talk about some far distant past thing that happened that gives the context for today's political issue or world issue, or that, James, you were just talking about you didn't enjoy the systems, building the systems of government as much. And I think that it's when somebody maybe drills down overtly into those politics that gets a little bit silly. I think that definitely throws me out. One of the other things, though, that throws me out about world building is when folks don't really clearly think about it. There is, and one of my big things is when, you know, oppression or power does not come out of economy, so we're just going to oppress you because we're jerks and not because there is a real economic issue, or that this is coming out of, you know, deeply how society works. I think that is poorly thought. I also feel very frustrated with stories that continue to reinforce elements of patriarchal culture without any deep thought about, you know, or comment, larger comment on how that's problematic.
I think we could have this discussion like every single time. you know, world building in general, like just things that bug the crap out of me. It's like, yeah, just stuff that doesn't make sense. I think you're right. If like, where does power come from? The whole idea that just somebody who's just plain evil sort of doesn't work for me anymore. You know, nobody thinks of themselves as evil. I want to know why they made that decision. And I'd like to know the consequences of how they feel. You know, do they have a hard time getting to sleep at night after they just committed genocide or whatever? But also, yeah, I read a lot of books that I think are, I shouldn't say I read a lot of books because I stopped reading them, where it's obvious the author hasn't thought through, or they're just kind of copying some trope. And that bugs me. I'd rather something be interesting, you know, different, or, you know, interesting in some way if they're going to play off an existing trope. If it's just a copy of a TV show, you know, we're just doing Buck Rogers again. Like, that's really just not interesting to me. So things within, like, in general, the world building, like if we just have an alien race and they just attacked us for no reason, like, I understand that we might not understand their motives or their whys, but I would like that to be addressed. You know, I would like, I don't know, just how carefully did the author think about it? That's the kind of thing that really throws me out. And I think doing the kind of exercise that we just kind of walk through here really helps add those details that add texture, you know?
How about for you, Molly?
When something is inconsistent, a lot of times that will really bug me. Like if something has been set up, so for example, let's say you have a society that is there is a patriarchy, but you also have magic in the world and men and women can be equally magical. So a lot of, you know, my assumption about the patriarchy is that it's founded in a time period when we needed, you know, strong men to do physical labor and women to do other types of labor. And so, you know, it was a might makes right kind of thing. And that's where the patriarchy comes. But if you live in a world where there's magic and it neutralizes that physical size difference, then why would there still be a patriarchy? So to me, like those two things, when you have set up systems in your world and those systems in your world don't necessarily match up with what my expectations are, that would really annoy me. The other thing, honestly, that really annoys me about world building is when a lot of names and concepts and ideas are thrown at me, but not in a context that I can understand. I think this can happen a lot of times if I'm picking up a series in the middle of it or in the beginning of books where there's just a lot of references that I don't get yet. I'm like, okay, just I want to ease into the story a little bit more.
And that can be a real challenge to think about, you know, if you're not doing, that's the balance between the info dump and the contextual clues, you know, so that's a challenge when it's done well. It's always a pleasure to read, you know, where you realize as you're going along that, oh, I do understand that.
And for me, the way that when I'm doing writing myself and I'm introducing new concepts or new ideas or doing some world building, I try to think of, okay, well, who is my reader? What would their assumption be? So, you know, let's say I'm writing this and I'm assuming that I'm writing this towards a Western, you know, North American US based family structure thing. So their assumption is probably going to be, there's going to be two parents. One is going to be a male. One is going to be female. So if I do anything other than that, I need to tell my reader ahead of time that that's not going to be the case. I need to prepare them for the fact that, you know, when the character goes home, there's going to be 8 moms and 12 dads, and that's totally the norm for that society, whatever the case may be. So think about in your world building, what is the normal world? What is our normal world? And then when your world is different from that, how so?
Yeah.
But at the same time, showing it as normal to those folks. So that's one of our challenges with world building, is that if it is a family with 8 moms and 12 dads, that's totally normal. And they're not going to go, and I'm going home to my family with 8 moms and 12 dads. That is a real challenge. How to signal what is different about the world without it not being in character. Because that is normal to them. So that is why having outside characters is so awesome for a lot of times, because we're seen through their eyes. That's a really good trick to show an unknown world, is to bring a stranger to that world in so that we can see it through their eyes. And that gives us a way to, you know, that gives you as an author a way to talk about, here are all the fun and funky things that are different about this world and how it works.
Which I feel like Ursula K. Le Guin did this just beautifully, especially in Left Hand of Darkness, where literally the point of view character is the outsider who's going through the world and saying, here's all the things that are different about this world, and I'm studying them. Mm-hmm. However, it does get very, on the one hand, that's a wonderful trick to use, and on the other hand, it does get info dumpy.
It does. How do you do it without, with a native character?
Yeah.
That's almost the topic for another podcast.
To be continued.
We've strayed from politics, yeah.
Strayed from politics to point of view.
Yeah. You know, thank you for listening. And I think that if you have ideas about politics and world building, we would love to hear them. As always, we'll have a place to do that on the website. This is a challenge, you know, and I think especially as readers, ideas about the amount of world building or even info dumping they'll accept change, you know, it's hard to find good examples of that. So we'd love to see some books that you think did it really well, and maybe even some that you think did really poorly, because that can be something to learn from as well. Yeah, please send us those ideas.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you for listening.
IO9, they had an